Hello, and welcome to today's episode, where we will dive deep into the fascinating world of banking, risk, and the regulations that very much keeps our financial world spinning. And as some of you may know, this is part of our ongoing series where we bring in industry experts to discuss some of the hottest topics in the regulatory landscape. And to take you through this journey, I'm your host, Rahul Chaudhary, Director of Risk at Broadstone. And today we have a very special guest with us who needs no introduction, but I will still go ahead and do the introduction. She's the Chief Model Risk Officer at Virgin Money and is often referred to as the Sherlock Holmes of risk management. So please join me in welcoming one and only Nidhi Agarwal. Nidhi, ready to solve some of the regulatory mysteries with us?
Absolutely, Rahul. Very interesting introduction. Very glad to be here. So thank you for having me. And yeah, let's follow the clues and see where the risk trail leads us.
Thanks, Nidhi. And before we dive into all the risk and regulations in banking and some of the technical and fun topics, I would say, it'll be great to hear about your remarkable professional journey. And I'm personally a big fan of your journey, which is not just inspiring for me, but I'm sure our listeners will find it very useful as well, those who are starting or in the mid of their journey in the risk world. So can you please start with from very beginning, starting with your school, your college days, and how you have achieved the amazing things you have, and probably including being part and driving strategic initiatives that you have within the big banks in the UK?
Of course, you know, I started my journey with a very strong foundation in mathematics. I'm a double master's in maths, and my first master's was in pure maths, but my second master's in financial maths. So that allows me to sort of pursue my passion for quantitative analysis. I started a job in risk modeling, and my career began with Lloyds DSB. Post that, I've been at Barclays and then HSBC, and I've been working on developing risk models and then frameworks and gradually then managing them. Now I lead a big function which does that. So I've had the privilege of working with some of the largest banks in the UK, really focusing on model risk management, regulatory compliance, and strategic risk initiatives. And yeah, it's been a very fulfilling journey so far of continuous learning, adapting to new challenges, and really staying ahead of the curve in a very evolving industry that we are in.
Sounds very exciting. And I mean, I know about that, but every time I hear about it, it's incredibly inspiring. And I know outside of work, you have been involved in a number of initiatives that help our community. So can you please give us some background on some of the key things you have been involved in as well?
Certainly. So outside of work, I'm very passionate about mentoring young professionals and students. You would see from my LinkedIn posts, I've been going into universities to teach them and helping them understand the careers in risk management and finance. So modules on risk management and finance is what I've been doing so far. I've also been involved in sort of mentoring within the company, women and sort of leadership who want to be from the underrepresented groups. I've also been collaborating with industry forums and think tanks to drive conversations really around sustainable risk, finance, and recently on AI in banking. So giving back to the community really and just fostering that next generation of risk professionals is something that's very close to my heart.
So, Nidhi, I mean, before we dive into some heavy technical but fun topics, like I said, how about a quick round of rapid fire
Let's
round?
Let's go for it. Yeah.
Perfect. And no overthinking, just your gut reaction as it comes.
Okay, I'll try.
All right. Okay, first one. Coffee or tea while managing risk models?
I'd say tea, masala chai, as they call it, keeps the nerves steady during a model meltdown.
And second one, so if your career was a movie title, so what would it be?
The good, the bad, and the risk averse.
Oh, love it. So third one, so if risk management were or kitchen appliance, what would it be and why?
A smoke detector, maybe always alert, sniffing out trouble before it burns down the house, I suppose.
love it. Anidhi, I mean, if you don't mind, I'm going to use some of these punchlines.
Go for it, yeah.
So let's move on to some of the meatier topics. And the first one to start is just the evolving banking landscape, which we keep talking about, and we know it's very interesting. So Nidhi, banking sector, for a very long time and more recently going through a rapid transformation. So from your perspective, what are the most significant challenges banks face today in terms of regulation and also in terms of competition?
It's a perfect storm, isn't it, Rahul? Banks are juggling right now with stricter regulations like Basel 3.1. There's a lot of rising customer expectations for digital innovation with AI around us. And then the geopolitical volatility that we are all surrounded with. So the key challenge really will be in how we balance compliance with agility.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Nidhi, you mentioned regulations and banks today face a tsunami of regulations, be it new IRB modeling related regulations or the likes of, like you said, Basel 3.1, climate disclosures. And I mean, now we are on 3.1, but it started back in 1988. Mm-hmm. So we've had different versions of it as we have gone along. So how do institutions keep up?
I'm totally, Rahul. It's like playing chess whilst juggling. Banks really need agile frameworks to get them through this journey. They need tech support, tech partnerships. And at the end of the day, it's really about having a culture of compliance, not just filling up checklists. So, yeah.
Nidhi, can you give an example of a recent regulation, that's particularly strained banks?
I mean, there are plenty, but if I have to take one, let's take the climate risk disclosures, right? The EU's CSRD and the UK's TCFD requirements demand very granular data capture on carbon footprint and transition plans.
Yeah.
Many banks currently lack the systems really to track this efficiently.
Yeah.
And then it eventually just ends up being a last minute scramble for everybody to get it put together.
Absolutely. And just to lighten the mood, given that heavy talk around the regulations, so if regulator threw a party, what song would they play?
I don't know. Under Pressure by Queen, maybe.
Perfect. Love the song. Let us see if we can actually play a snippet of that song. Maybe not, given the copyright issues, and not sure. And probably I can check with my compliance team. And actually, on that note, note for the listeners that if you are in doubt, always consult your compliance team. They will direct you in the right and the safe direction, as always. And Nidhi, actually, the song is stuck in my head. Pushing down, pressing down on you. I definitely can't sing. So I'm in the right profession. I'll stick with risk management. Moving on to the next topic within the evolving landscape. Fintechs versus traditional banks. Mm. Fintechs are the cool kids on the block. Are traditional banks doomed, or is this a collaboration waiting to happen?
Really, you can't say they're doomed. Banks bring trust and infrastructure, right? And what fintechs do is they bring speed and innovation. So they both have a part to play. And together, I would say, they're the Avengers of finance,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Marriage made in heaven.
Yes.
And within that, so what specific areas do you see as the most promising one for mm-hmm. collaboration between these two?
Plenty. Maybe we can take examples like open banking, real-time payments, AI-driven customer insights, fraud detection, and cybersecurity is a big one. There are lots of such examples where collaboration can be extremely useful.
Yeah.
Lately, following all the different news that comes out in the market, there's a lot of alliance happening between fintechs and the big firms, which is very exciting. Mm. And I'm pretty sure it's going to continue to happen as well. So thanks for that. And moving to the next one, Nidhi, around geopolitical risk, which we hear quite a lot, from trade wars to crypto crackdowns. How do banks prepare for the unpredictable?
Very good. And that's going to just increase, right, the unpredictability around us as we discuss the geopolitical risk. So scenario planning will be the real key in my mind. You know, you think of it as like choose your own adventure book, where every ending involves stress testing.
Yeah.
And if you can survive that, that's when you know that you will be geared up for the unknowns coming to you.
Perfect. I mean, our regulator's favorite always.
Yes.
So, and Nidhi, I mean, just following up on that, so how do sanctions like these, how do banks keep up with those?
So sanctions definitely create a compliance minefield, right? It's about banks needing to screen every transaction in real time, update systems overnight. Sometimes it's required to freeze assets. And all whilst trying to still make sure that, you know, you avoid the collateral damage to legitimate customers. Mm. So it is a big task in itself.
Yeah, indeed scary if you get it wrong. So yeah. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thanks, Nidhi, for that. Moving on to the next one, our favorite, Basel 3.1 and the capital. And given, I mean, we know that Basel 3.1 is a major regulatory overhaul, and it's pretty much like the Hunger Games for banks. Stricter capital rules, fewer loopholes. Break it down for us, please.
See, 3.1, maybe I'll put them into three pillars, right? One, enhanced capital buffers. Two, standardized risk weights. And three, transparency. It's really about ensuring that banks hold sufficient capital against your operational and credit risk losses. It's really about creating a level playing field globally, right? Banks must now prove that they're not just too big to fail, but they're also too smart to fail.
Probably another punchline I'm going to use, Nidhi. So, thanks in advance. and how are, probably bigger banks, but how about the smaller banks? How are they coping with these demands compared to larger institutions?
And it is definitely more challenging for the smaller banks, right? They face more resourcing gaps and access to all those resources. Huh. They often lack the budgets, for example, for advanced data infrastructure,
yeah,
which then forces them to rely on third-party vendors, which obviously has its own risks that comes along. And therefore, I think consolidation in the sector will probably be likely.
Right. And just sticking to the same, so in terms of implementation challenges, what's the biggest headache for the banks right now?
I think data in capital, right?
Always.
DATA, always. So imagine like building a puzzle where half of your pieces are missing. And that's what is a data challenge. Banks really need clean, integrated data lakes to feed these models to make it all work.
Yeah, indeed. Data is always a challenge, irrespective of which regulation you're dealing with. And if, on the lighter note, if Basel 3.1 were a movie genre, so what would it be?
Maybe a heist thriller, I would say. Banks racing against the clock to meet deadlines.
I was going to ask, what are the consequences of missing Basel 3.1 deadlines? But, I mean, having known that Basel 3.1 timelines have moved a couple of times over the last couple of months, I think now the latest one is it needs to be implemented by 1st of January 2027, if
yes.
I remember it
yeah.
right. But assuming there are a lot of other things into consideration at this point. But assuming we are going to stick with those timelines, so what are the challenges that you see?
challenges in terms of delivering or challenges in terms of if we don't deliver by that date, what happens?
So challenges in terms of if you don't deliver on time.
If you don't deliver on time, of course, you will be facing the wrath of the regulators through regulatory penalties or capital add-ons or, I mean, in fact, reputational damage, right, overall. So, yeah, I mean, people are looking at compliance much more strictly, and therefore meeting these things from a governance point of view is critical.
Nidhi, moving on to the next and slightly related topic, which feeds into everything we do, is the model risk management, which is what is called the silent guardian, and which is another of your specialties. So for the listeners, those who are new to the model risk management, could you explain what exactly is model risk and why should banks care?
So it's a great question. Everybody should know about model risk and care about model risk, right? It's a danger that a flawed algorithm or assumption leads to catastrophic decisions at the end of the day. Huh. It's like, imagine a self-driving car's GPS sending it off a cliff, right? That's model risk in banking, pretty much, right? So banks have to care because a single faulty model can trigger massive losses, regulatory fines, or even reputational damage, collapse, right?
Yeah, scary indeed.
Yeah.
To put it in perspective, can you share an example where model risk management averted a potential crisis?
We did, right? There was a credit scoring model we had, which was disproportionately penalizing customers, and we had to recalibrate the inputs, which then reduced the bias and improved the lending fairness, which then obviously led us to sort of prevent any financial or reputational fallout.
Yeah. Very, very important to keep testing it to make sure that it continues to do what it does. I mean, models aren't just mathematical poetry, like what some of us, the math or the stat geeks, call it. How do you make sure the models are reliable and not just mathematical poetry?
I think you just touched upon that when you said testing them, right?
Yeah.
It's like you treat models as parachutes. You wouldn't use them and jump before testing them. So every model, therefore, really has to go through a validation where you're checking whether it's conceptually sound. So essentially, does the math really hold up?
Yeah.
Whether there's data integrity, which, you know, we all know, garbage in, garbage out. And whether the outcomes are strong, as in, like, does it really work in the real world?
Yeah. I mean, all the standard testing that we should do.
Totally.
Excellent. And can you automate model risk management, or is this just a human-only zone?
No, you can. I think balance is going to be key, of course, right? So you have to use AI, and you can do that for a lot of things, flagging outliers and feature selection, or when you have vast amount of data, making sense of it. And you really have to do that. But then at the end of the day, humans have to make the final call. So models can't explain themselves, right, why they are biased. So which is why human in the loop is exceptionally important.
Yeah. Nidhi, I've got a lot of questions on AI, which we're going to cover later on in next couple of sections. So, but thanks for that. And just sticking on to what you said about the bias.
Yeah.
How do you tackle the black box problem in complex model, which is quite a common thing that we tend to face?
And I think explainability really is the key word for that, right? If a model can't justify its decisions in plain English, it's then going back to the drawing board. You really have to build a model that is explainable. And we have some thresholds and standards and what we expect from that.
Yeah. And I mean, just on that, one of the key questions that we get asked all the time is, how do you handle third-party models? And it's a concern from the regulator as well. And we tend to hear that quite a lot. So what are your views on this?
There will be obviously instances where you have to go to a third-party vendor model. You'll not be able to build everything in-house. But you, of course, want to hold them to the same standards. They have to still meet your internal model risk management policy and governance expectations that you meet, make your internal models meet, right? So we therefore mandate a full transparency. They should be able to share code or data or validation reports. Maybe we'll institute our own validations before we use those models. So really, even if it means delaying go-live dates, it's very important that we all feel comfortable in internally to onboard that model and use it for our material decision-making purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on to another of my favorite topic on which a regulator has been publishing a lot of guidance around climate risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So climate risk is increasingly on the radar for banks and for the regulator as well. So how are institutions integrating these risks into their strategic planning?
By making themselves more forward-looking, right? It's about really embedding stress testing, climate scenarios into your stress testing exercises and loan pricing. And institutions have started doing that quite a lot. There was a CBES exercise run by the PRA, which was a good example. If you have a mortgage in a flood-prone area, you will obviously want to have a higher risk premium for that versus not in a flood-prone area. So those things you have to start building in your decision-making process now.
Yeah. From your perspective, what do you think, what role should regulators play in standardizing the climate risk frameworks?
I think it'll evolve. We're not there fully yet, but I think regulators should start harmonizing the definitions for the metrics like carbon footprints, transition timelines. And I think the UK, like I mentioned, the UK CBES exercise conducted by the PRA was a step in the right direction, to be honest. It's a great example.
So, Nidhi, next section, how can we finish without talking about AI? AI in banking. So, I mean, AI, talking about both the Gen AI and machine learning, has been expanding in banking world very rapidly. So where do you see its biggest impact, and what would be the ethical consideration must banks prioritize?
See, so far, I think we haven't fully harnessed the power of AI. We have been using it in fraud detection and, you know, personalized services, sort of chatbots and those kind of things. But I think a lot more could be done, and there is work that is happening. At the end of the day, explainability, like I said, is non-negotiable. Our customers, they deserve to know why a loan was denied if we have used AI for their model or a transaction was flagged, right? We need to be transparent in being able to clearly explain our decisions.
Yeah, yeah. And Nidhi, just sticking on that. So as you said, AI can predict risk and can detect fraud. And now we know it can write poetry as well, yes, along with being your personal assistant. So are we handing over the keys to Skynet?
I think we need to be just very, very clear. It's a tool. I really see it as a tool. I don't think it's a replacement. Yeah, it's just like example we gave earlier. It's a GPS. It guides us, but humans will still steer. So it's not a replacement. We shouldn't get worried about that.
Yeah, like it. I mean, a lot of us will be comfortable just hearing that. So thank you. And like I said, I've got a lot of questions on AI. So mm-hmm. a few more, I'll throw at you. And I mean, you were talking about the trust and bias in AI model, which is a hot topic. Everyone has been discussing that. So how do we ensure fairness?
By using diverse set of data. So train your model on a variety and a huge volume of data. Ensure there's human oversight. And then at the end of the day, make sure that you're able to explain. So explainability thresholds are met, right? If a model is a black box, I mean, it's just a fancy paperweight.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And what's your take on regulators mandating AI audits, for instance?
Quite essential, right? I mean, I wouldn't see them any different, like financial audits, where AI audits need to ensure that there's accountability. I think the EU's AI Act is a very good start in the right direction. It helps you classify high-risk AI systems and what mandates rigorous testing. So that's a good start, and we just need to take it through now.
Yeah, and I think EU AI Act, which is very detailed, and hopefully I think we're going to have something similar within UK as well, probably even more detailed than what the EU Act is. But Yeah, I totally agree. The steps in the right direction. So, Nidhi, I'm going to ask you the question that everyone has been asking. Will AI replace risk managers by 2030? And how do you address these fears that everyone has about that AI could replace jobs in risk management?
Honestly, I think they're unfounded. Yes, you'll not do the same job, but you will do a different job. Yeah, it will make us 10 times faster. We'll focus on more value-add kind of things like strategy, not spreadsheets. AI is supposed to automate repetitive tasks, data scrubbing and all those, which I don't think a lot of people want to do either anyways, right? So it frees up teams for strategic work. So I think we should really embrace it. We have to upskill our employees. We have started doing that quite a lot to focus on AI oversight and ethical governance. It's really, really about augmentation, not replacement.
Yeah, yeah. So before we wrap up, I mean, if you could leave our listeners with one mantra, what would it be?
Curiosity. I think people need to stay curious and never stop asking questions, right? What if? What if?
Yeah. And Nidhi, thanks for joining us. And thanks to all the listeners for joining us. Please remember, in risk management, the only constant is change. So stay savvy, stay sharp. And like Nidhi said, keep questioning. See you soon.
Thank you.